This is Betty Smith, May 15th, 1992. Voice of the Self.
Friday, May 15, Cornish North, 1992. Betty Smith speaks for the Jung Society, the voice of the self.
I understand that the Pythia, the priestess of Apollo at Delphi, not that there's any comparison here, but I'm going to be talking about Delphi tonight. And the priestess, when she sits upon the tripod and makes ready to hear the voice of Apollo and deliver the oracle, she must hold the woolen thread that's attached to the omphalos, which is very close to the tripod in the inner sanctuary of the Temple of Apollo. It was in ancient times. I'd like to just propose or give you a little idea of what I'm going to do this evening. As you notice, the subject sounded a little on the general side, the voice of the self. I say that in a collective kind of way. Let's hope that's my last collective remark. There isn't anything ever collective about the self. And if there's anything that summons us in a most individual manner, it is the self. It is the greater self in a very specific way. But we are focusing on the self and the bridge to the voice to the self, or the voice of the self as a bridge to consciousness. And looking at it through some of the imagery that comes down to us from ancient Greece, and in particular at the oracle site of Delphi, which is about 3 hours from Athens in very beautiful, wild country even yet today. And this was the great, called the center of the earth. The two eagles that were released, one going one direction and one the other direction, met again after circling the earth, which was supposed to be square and flat, circling it and coming back to Delphi and declaring that this indeed was the center of the earth. We know certain other cities, sacred cities, have made this claim, and we won't linger over that as a historic point, but rather it was the sacred center of Greece. And what it means to us to project the sacred center on a place and on a way of approaching the inner world, on a way approaching the necessity of finding one's way or finding the answer. So that the ancient process of consulting the oracle at Delphi, as well as consulting oracles in other parts of Greece, but especially at Delphi, stands as an archetypal journey, an archetypal imagery of how it happens, of how we cross the important and awesome threshold between consciousness and the realm of the gods, the realm of the great archetypes. So I hope to talk a little bit physically and historically, just a little, to give you the flavor of the place. And primarily, I will talk about the images symbolically. There's a reason for talking about it physically, too. It isn't to get you to go to Greece with me. Trip's almost full right now. But it's but I would like that if you go sometime. But it's because in those ancient times, especially from about 700 BC to 400 AD, that center there was a place in which nature and spirit were not split, really were not split. So that the natural surroundings, the presence of nature there is not just pretty scenery, or isn't this great to be out of Athens and see this for the ancient as well as for the modern, but it is very expressive of the nature of the gods. The whole site is. So that's why I've decided to make this focus particularly on Delphi, and also because in my very first trip to Greece, which was in 1962, it was for me the most compelling experience and quite overwhelming indeed. And I knew very little about it at that point and was to learn more later. But the sense of the place was really overwhelming. I want to talk about Delphi. I want to talk about what it is to approach, to approach the oracle and getting oneself ready as the questioner, the approach of the questioner to shape the question. Not a thing of words, really, although it was given in words then, but the fundamental question, the question that arises out of one's situation, out of one's predicament, the essential situation, the essential predicament, where one is stopped somehow in one's existence, and out of that, the shape of the question, and how one prepares for that, and then something about the nature, some characteristics of the answer, of the god's answer, through Pythia, the priestess. And then I would like to share with you a dialogue that has to do with Heracles' visit to Delphi. And about our, I believe that Heracles shows our great modern temptation to run away with the oracle, to run away with the power of the oracle, to run away with our answers. So that will come last, as it were. And so first I'm going to, well, let's just say that getting the answer is really a modern passion. When you think of us as American people, as Westerners, we really have a passion to know. And our curiosity is highly developed. It isn't always intellectual curiosity, but one high form of it is intellectual curiosity, which makes possible the motivation for research, study, science, what have you. We couldn't do without that kind of curiosity. But it also is has developed in us, in our age particularly, the spectator-observer. Now, the emphasis is spectator here. I'm indebted to the French philosopher Marcel, Gabriel Marcel, who wrote in this century, for pointing out his anguish and concern about our getting set in the spectator, and that the imaginal and participatory aspect that makes us vital is going dead. He was writing in this manner in the 1950s in some of his plays. He was terribly concerned that the spectator was taking us over, was distancing us all the time from life. Life is an object. Life is a subject. Everything is a subject. And of course, we will follow any subject at all. Our TV shows bear witness to this. We will follow any subject at all in order to enhance our information or just to have a look. Just to have a look and not to get bored for that particular period of time. So we're also dealing in our curiosity and in our involvement with looking at so many varied things, we are involved with our something with our acquisitive nature too. not just inquisitive nature, but acquisitive nature. Something of our materialism. We want to find the answer, getting back to the passion for the answer or the information or the facts. We want to find it, but we want hard coinage in that information. We want something we can carry away and pocket or put in the notebook or deal in as commodity, or we want hard coinage. Well, that was something that the ancients would have thought was hubris to make such a demand. That is to say, it would have been not just the sin of pride, but the sin of acting like a god, is to tell the gods exactly the kind of answer that's acceptable to you. The gods' answers were so varied, Apollo's answers, that he came to have, one of his titles was, well, his great title was Phoebus. Phoebus, Apollo, light, light. And Artemis, his twin, took the title Phoebe. And he was a great light-bearing god. He was not a sun god as such. I know we do associate him somewhat, especially the Romans did, to the chariot of the sun. But really, he's not the body of the sun like Helios. He brings a rare kind of light up to human consciousness. And even the ancients recognize this. But another title that he bears, besides the wearer of the laurel, because he wore a wreath of laurel, always reminded him of his lost love, and lost in a sense, anyway, his love for Daphne, who was called the laurel. But also he had the name Loxias, L-O-X-I-A-S. And Loxias, the poets often addressed him that way. Loxias, it means the devious, because some of his answers were so difficult. So I thought I should warn you about that one. Because when we talk about dreams, which we will do more tomorrow than today, when one talks about dreams, and many of us here are interested in following our dreams, I'm sure, and other material that comes from the unconscious inner work, there is this, there's a great deal that can be complex, ambiguous, and very, very indirect, not direct kind of answers sometimes. But this is the nature of the self. Much of what curiosity leads us, our curiosity, modern curiosity, leads us towards, a lot of it is not strictly relevant knowledge. Some of it's relevant to us. I mean, not relevant necessarily to me or you as an individual. I'm quite willing to learn about the mating customs of a people in a distant locale that I may never meet or see. It's interesting. It's interesting. Or I may talk about, look at the possibilities of life on a distant planet because it's interesting, but not strictly relevant to my life situation or my predicament. When you came to the oracle place in ancient times, really just as when you come into serious inner work, you do come with an attitude relevant to your situation and your predicament. And you are open to receive, must be open, not for general knowledge, but for the very specific thing which is a gateway to your psyche. To your psyche. And it's probably the reason that the when you stop to think of it, that the great god Hermes was called, he was the god of souls as well as god of the road or the journey. but he was the God of the gateway. Because if you don't make the connection between two realms, conscious and unconscious, earth and underworld, as the myths say, or earth and Olympus, where the gods are, if you can't cross the threshold or find the gateway of crossing, then the connection can't be made. So it's this is one of the things we'll be looking for, too, thinking about what are the kind of experiences or ways we prepare ourselves that can be gateway, a gateway that opens to between the two realms. Now, I would also like to say that the oracle is a bridge between conscious and unconscious, to put it psychologically, or between the human realm and the realm of the gods. Now, not that those are perfectly equivalent, but that's the mythological way of saying it. Jung was very taken and concerned with the connection between the number one and the number two personality, remember? How early in his life he felt the presence of a very awesome kind of reality, which he came to name the number two personality. The oracle is a bridge between, in ourselves, between the number one and the number two personality. I'm only happy with that if the number two personality includes the transcendence of the gods, a kind of otherness that belongs to the gods. I think of it more as a window that's open in the psyche rather than as the god is never a fixture, or he, she never has a permanent seat in the psyche. Rather, the psyche is, I like to think, is more like a theater or a stage in which the gods move back and forth and cross. The stage does not own the players. The theater does not own the actors, but they move freely on the stage. And it seems to me that that is what we gather from the ancients as a relationship between the human being and the gods, or the great archetypes. As you come into Delphi, I said I would say something about it physically. As you arrive at this great gorge in the mountains, above the Bay of Corinth, and above the little valley that made by the Plestos River, which is only a stream today, there are two towering cliffs, perpendicular cliffs, called the Phaedriades, that overlook and somehow have the force of limiting the scene. They bring the eye upward. There's an enormous sense of heaven and earth in this scene. But just below the Phaedriades, on a high plateau, a rocky plateau, is the site of the Temple of Apollo. There have been different temples. They have fallen to earthquake and fire over the centuries. The first one was probably around 700 or 800 BC. And when one would fall, another would come. And the poet said that we have to accept that finally the lightnings of Zeus or the movements of the earth will take even the Temple of Apollo. But then they would build again on the same site. Also coming out from much higher up, this is Mount Parnassus, famous Mount Parnassus. Higher up on Mount Parnassus are the sources of the two great springs for which Delphi is known. One of these is the Castalia, the spring, which has come for poets in our times to be the from 16th century on, the stream of inspiration, for especially for poets. But in those days, it was where the pilgrims cleansed themselves, at least bathed their heads, especially to put the water of Castalia on the head as a cleansing or a purification rite. And the priestess Pythia always did this before she went to sit on the tripod in the season in which she gave the oracle. There was another important spring, and it's called Kasotis. It is a little above the temple, and it was an underground spring, but came up at one spot, I guess. It was especially sacred, so sacred that when the priestess was on the tripod, the little three-legged kind of pot, three-legged cauldron that she sat upon, of all things, in the inner sanctuary, she was brought a cup of water from the kasotis, which she drank. So in one hand, she drank the water. In one hand, she held the woolen thread from the omphalos, and with the other, she held a laurel branch, a small branch of laurel, which is the sacred tree of Apollo. I mentioned that it belonged to his love, Daphne. And then she would wait. There's always a great pause with the question. There never comes enough craftsmanship or skill that you don't have to wait on the gods. Never. There is something I like to call the priestess pause that Pythia has. And they were enormously dependent on her to... some scholars say they don't believe she babbled, and other poets called it a babble. But in any case, they have all agreed that there was an ecstasy that came to her when she was ready to prophesy or give the oracle. She was entheos, they say in Greek. Entheos. She was filled with God. In God. The Apollo comes to her and speaks in the first person. She doesn't say, "I heard Apollo say." Apollo speaks in the first person through Pythia, and even her voice was said to change with this speaking. We know that there were also priests, male priests, who delivered the oracle after receiving it from Pythia, put it in verse. Some say they think some of the priestesses did verse also. It was a kind of a quatrain that was used. Now, I described this place, and I want to say something about three great images there. One is the Sphinx. It was a gift of the people of Naxos, and it stood on a high column right before the temple, but it was there for almost 1,000 years, I think. And fortunately, they have it in the museum in Delphi today. It was one of the things that survived. But this beautiful sculpture, as you would come up from the bay, more likely you would come by ship rather than road. Some people came by road in ancient times. And you would make your way up through Olive Grove and first give your offering at the Temple of Athena. The oldest worship in this area was the worship of the goddess. Not of Athena first, but first of Gethemis, who was the first holder of the oracle. And the site of that is more or less in this little valley below the Temple of Apollo, where the temples of Athena were built. And Athena was keeper of the gate to Apollo. She was called Athena before the... Athena Pronaya, Athena before the temple, Athena before the temple. And you would pass that, make your offering, and go up then to the spring, Castalian spring, and then on to present yourself when ready to the priest to be received by Pythia at the temple. But you would see, as you approached from the temple of Athena, rising up this path, you would see this great sphinx in stone, in marble, that marvelous amberish marble with which the Noxians use. Part woman, part lion, part had its bird-like qualities too. And I wonder what this says about the place of the question and the questioner, that ultimately, somehow, you are still left with Sphinx, that if you get a vision when you come with the question, as you approach the greater realm of the self, the deeper self, which certainly the gods are images of, you are still left with something of the mystery and the enigma of existence. Something can never be said. Something can never be explained. And it must have been an extremely powerful presence to have this actual image. And then a second great image is the Omphalos, which I mentioned was within the sanctuary, in the inner sanctuary, where the Pythia was. Now, sometimes city-states made a gift of an omphalos. There are some in the museum, but this original one, the most sacred one, was there, very, very old. It's an old stone, great mound-shaped stone, symbol, an image of the earth, and it was wrapped with yarn about it. It may have had a pillar at one point on it. And Omphe means divine voice. Omphe. And phallos is being the generative organ. You have the divine generative voice. A very androgynous thing. It was very much connected to the goddess before Apollo, G. Themis, the Omphalos. You see it in vase paintings with the goddess. It was very holy to Apollo. So they're both the masculine and the feminine in this great shrine that come together in this place of wisdom. Now let's see, I thought I said a third image, didn't I? Could have been the golden Apollo. There was a golden statue of Apollo also in the inner sanctuary. I think it was the tripod I wanted to speak of, however, very particularly. The tripod where the priestess alone sat was said to have, now I've only read this in one or two scholars, but was said to have the teeth and the bones, the teeth and the bones of Python in the pot. Now, this is the great serpent. This is the great dragon that Apollo slew, the companion of G. Themis. And legend said that he was a great seer, a serpent seer. And this is these are the remains of the great seer in the pot. Some say that the base of the tripod was the tomb of Dionysos. There's nothing that suggests a tomb in the physical appearance in the sculptures and paintings. But they said that the lower steps of the tripod represented the tomb of Dionysus. And there was a resurrection rite to the god that was performed there. You know, Dionysos is the only Greek god who dies and comes again. You know, was more like Christ in that respect. And Parnassos was his mountain, as well as Apollo's. In the wintertime, Apollo took his vacation. In the wintertime, he went to the Vale of Tempe, which is where he first fell in love with Daphne, where the Peneus River is in Thessaly, and it's very, it's a very wooded vale. I mean, it was then, a very wooded and comforting place, not high and windy like Delphi. And Dionysos would take over the temple in the wintertime. But the oracle was not given then. The oracle was given by Apollo. Why even mention these things? Well, not for the, these ancient ways of doing things. It's not to serve the category of the interesting. It's not just to satisfy curiosity. Kierkegaard kind of rebuked us in the 19th century for doing so many things under the category of the interesting. Something that just barely pleases our senses, sets us up for that time, but doesn't affect us. In contrast to the category of existence, as he called it, where things matter, infinitely matter to us. So it is not to satisfy the interesting or the curiosity, but rather to show us our own essential continuity of the objective psyche. After all, the psyche experienced this. The great collective psyche experienced these things. This is the rich floor of the psyche when these images were very alive and were in the making. And I've noticed in tours to Greece some very important dreams come out of Delphi for people, oftentimes, or important experiences, so that the psyche does connect. So it brings up the whole notion of continuity. I think the psyche in us loves continuity and hates discontinuity. So when you do something brand new, be sure you do some kind of ritual of connection to the seed or the thread that went before, so that you keep the organic and essential thread, you keep the archetype satisfied that goes back in. For the Greeks, the whole image of continuity was not just myth, although myth expressed it, and not just the worship and the temples, but the goddess, Mnemosyne. And that's memory, Mnemosyne, and all of her children, all of her progeny, the Muses, frequented Delphi. And Apollo was Musagetes. He was the leader of the Muses. They used to come and dance in the evenings at Delphi. So there is, these are offsprings of memory. These have to do with continuity, but the Muses specifically have to do with expressing and channeling what is mythological, what is archetypal, what is important to the psyche into expression. Channeling that into some form of enduring expression. Song, dance, in some cases knowledge like astronomy, history. Jung said that the most important aspect of his work was to address the ineffable, unlockable symbols. And he said that if we don't bring ourselves to these symbols, these great symbols, we get swallowed up by understanding, and that understanding becomes demonic. He used that term in one of his letters, written, I think, in the 1930s, that actually understanding can become demonic unless we allow something to be expressed through the mystery of the symbols. He thought it was very important that not everything be verbalized. The name for oracle, I forgot to give you, is Chrismos, almost like our word Christmas, only it doesn't have a T in it. As it transliterated, Chrismos, the oracle. And it means the needful answer, the needful answer. One could almost say relevant, but it's more than relevant. It's exactly what matters and answers to the situation. Now I'd like to say a little bit about approaching. We've said something about putting aside the observer spectator in favor of having the imaginal layer in oneself stirred. The images, a rather receptive side of one's consciousness and capacity. Not a side that manipulates, not imagination in the sense of some manipulation, but to receive the images and to be very present to a scene or to what the unconscious brings. That would be opening to the imaginal level. There is an art piece from ancient Eleusis that expresses this very well. They showed in a little relief two sets of eyes, and the eyes at the top, I believe it's the ones at the top, are closed as though blinded, and the ones at the bottom are open. And at first some people thought that meant there was a healing that had taken place, that the blind had been made to see. But there were not physical healings at Eleusis. But it was the great mystery. And there was a certain kind of seeing. And I wonder if that's not more the spectator, the curiosity kind of seeing, that in which there is a conscious closing of that vision in favor of opening the inner eyes. Hillman says in his book, Dream in the Underworld, there's nothing the psyche desires more than to see. To see, to penetrate life with sight, really to see through or into. So that is one of the ways as we begin to have more inner seeing and the images begin to be active in us. There is a kind of taming of the questioner that has to take place for a modern person, of that wild sensation function that wants to gather all the facts at once. And I like the way Jung said it in a letter to Lillian Fry Roan. He said, one must learn to walk in the dark as one who is learning to swim. See if the water will carry one. See if the water will carry one. Actually, he was talking about not getting answers, not getting direct answers and conscious answers so much, but really going with where the unconscious is leading until, and that in a way is walking in the dark. So I think that's necessary in the approach to the voice of the self or the oracle. I think one affirms, it's necessary to affirm that there is a place or a source of wisdom that my ego doesn't know anything about. My ego, your ego, doesn't know anything about. And so one does affirm the God realm or the archetypes or the wisdom of the unconscious. There is that. That's affirmed. And then I think there is a kind of expectation that's very important. One sees this in the faces of children. It's a kind of light or glow of waiting and hopefulness that's in the faces of children. And we have to recapture some of that in order for inner work to work. There has to be some sense of expectation. Nothing false or assumed, but enough life, vitality, and hopefulness in oneself to look for, to wait for, to let something come. So I think expectation is a very important part. I think it's a very active kind of response. It's not passive. Now we're going to need to take our break, aren't we? Just a minute. I'd just like to mention Theseus first before we take our break. Theseus came to ask the oracle a question when he was a very young man. He had just discovered his father, king of Athens. He had been brought up by his mother in the south of Greece. His father was a very weak king, King Aegeus. And there was this terrible thing of the tribute to Crete. As you know, 14 youths and maidens being sent to the labyrinth in Crete, to the Minotaur, every 7 years, was it? So Theseus went to Delphi, and his question was a very direct reality question for his young life. Shall I go to Crete, or will I be going to Crete? Now, they drew lots to go, you see, but he really wanted to know whether this was his destiny or not. And the oracle answered him, yes, go to Crete. Go to the labyrinth of Crete. But take Aphrodite in the boat with you. It's interesting. So he did take a sacred image of Aphrodite in the boat, there at the helm of the boat. And indeed, Aphrodite did affect his life greatly through his love for Ariadne. Ariadne's love for him. It was, sometimes people came for direction for their lives. And that's just an example of how practical the questions were. And once you got the question, once you got the reply of the God, whether you could understand it or not, it was unarguable. You didn't say, well, I guess I'll go for a second opinion. I'll stop back at Trophonius's place in Lavadia or someplace, a lesser oracle. No, you didn't get by with that. And it was unarguable. It had a finality in it. And there was very great trust given. So I would say trust played a part. A relationship that when you gave something honestly to the self and said, here I am, and here's this predicament, here's my life, then you got some kind of answer that made some kind of sense. Now we have all the legendary answers in which Apollo, when he had been not a very long time at Delphi, it was a shrine from 1500 BC, but it was probably the goddess shrine all those early years. And Apollo came 700 or 800, something like that. They don't know for sure. But there was a temple in this 7th century. When Apollo was fairly early at Delphi, he was said to have gone to Zeus. And this is recorded by the playwright Euripides in the play Iphigenia in Tauris. He went to Zeus and he said he had a big complaint to make. And he said nobody was paying attention to him at Delphi. No one was paying any attention to his oracle. That everybody was getting dreams. Everybody was getting dreams. And he wanted Zeus to rebuke Themis, the goddess Themis, who had previously had the oracle, for sin or earth, her mother, they were considered together, G, Themis, rebuke earth and her daughter for sending these dreams because he couldn't get through with his oracle. And we presume that, well, according to Euripides, the dream ceased after that. Now, I thought it was a very interesting thing, because what would cause the playwright to write that? No. It must be that it was a very powerful dream place there at Delphi, that the unconscious was really stirred there. And for many centuries before Apollo came, there is the collective unconscious of the place, many years before he came, the oracle was given through the dream. That is, somebody came and had the dream. We don't even know the procedure. There's no written literature on the oracle of G. Themis. But there was a, they found a sanctuary of hers there, down in the Athena area, as I mentioned previously. I've seen some pretty powerful dreams come from modern individuals, contemporary individuals in the 20th century, from staying over at Delphi. And one man told me a dream and said I could use it. They gave me a book at the end with the people's dreams in it and poems. And he had spent quite a bit of time, like till midnight or 1 o'clock, in the moonlight at Delphi, and had made a trip down and climbed over the fence to go into the area of the Marmolia, which is the marble areas around Athena's temple. And that night, and it was such a beautiful night, he dreamed that a very primitive warrior came up and shot him in the arm. I think it was the right arm. Shot him in the right arm. He was deeply, you know, wounded. And then it seemed that it became like a hypodermic, in that something was being poured into him through the arm. Something was being poured into the arm. And then he was supported on either side, I don't remember all the details, and carried forward. And he knew that it was some kind of initiation for him that was taking place. And he had not had any background, particularly in mythology. He did not know that Apollo, for example, was known for bow and arrow. The early Apollo was known for his bow and arrow. And it's very interesting that he had a dream that with the primitive hunter or warrior figure, which is very much like the god. I've seen moving cave dreams there, huge cave. The cave was very important to women because high up on the mountain were the celebration of the Dionysian rites in the wintertime up in the Corycian cave. And I've seen very important cave dreams. Well, I want to say just a little bit, because we don't have much time left, about the God's reply, I like to feel that in the God's reply is the presence of those powerful images of, that the Sphinx is there somehow, that the Omphalos, representing the depths of underworld and earth knowledge, is there, the earth connection, deep connection to life in the Omphalos, which is called the navel of the earth. For one thing, one lets go of the question when one gives it to the God. There's a point at which one lets go of the question, which is to say one lets go of the problem. One lets go of the problem. Now, one lets go of one's possessive hold on the problem. I can't talk about this same problem forever in the same terms. I can't go on talking about what a bad time I had or what I mean, once I've come to this place, this particular monumental and significant encounter with the self, there is something that changes. One lets go of the question in some appropriate sense. I think the reply is always very individual. There are historic accounts. The work of Professor Fontenrose, entitled The Delphic Oracle, is a very important historic work on the, it gives the historic oracles from Delphi. And it also gives the legendary ones, the ones they can't find a historical reference for. But you will find them very individual. Not a general ethical principle, not a general moral statement at all, but very specifically, yes, go back to your island and buy that piece of land and build an altar to Artemis, or go back to Athens and know you shall not plow the sacred territory of the goddesses, of Demeter, in the marketplace of Athens, even though her temple needs repair. Everything very, very specific, very individual. And I think this is probably very important to us because it honors the individual totally. The truth is exactly customized for the individual. Or it's not always an individual person. Sometimes it was an individual city-state that had brought the question. We said it was unarguable. There's a sense that it comes from afar. There's something transcendent. There's something that is not, that it has the characteristic of spirit or transcendence in it. And Apollo had a title that expressed that. He was called Farshooter. Farshooter. Not only shot far, but he shot from afar. And there is this sense of distance, of spirit captured into life, into the individual's life. And there, it carries a sense of summons, the God's reply. You really feel, well, now I move. Now it's time. The God has replied. The oracle has replied, and now I can move. So there is a rather strong sense of summons in it. And we said already that it had the priestess pause in it. There is a waiting quality before it comes. But what I would like to share with you, and then in order to leave some time for your question, is Heracles coming to the, this is in the form of a dialogue that I've written. I will skip over part of it. I mean, I will edit it as I read, so it won't be too long. it seems that Heracles came to Apollo at Delphi. It will turn out very soon what he asked for. He came to consult after the death of his children. He had some terrible events in his life, you know. He slew his children in a fit of madness. So it was after that time. He'd already been purified from that. And he came to get the priestess, and the priestess would not see him. She refused to see him. Now, he's a very famous hero, and Heracles, whom the Romans called Hercules, okay? And she said, "Man of Thebes, I have no oracle to give you." And she would not have anything to do with it. So he was very, very angered at this. The priestess could not quite be forced, and he seized the tripod and carried it off, the sacred tripod, took it out of the inner sanctuary, took it out of the whole temple, and was headed down to the Bay of Corinth with the tripod. Now, this is where the dialogue starts. This was my own work with it. And he went shouting, "I'll establish my own oracle." So he's going down in a certain place where the path narrows. He rounds a curve, and there in the middle of the path is Apollo. Is Apollo himself. And this is based on the myth, the myth or legend. "All hail, Lord Apollo. I'd not expected to meet you treading the path for the answer like one of us." He smiled a little foolishly. Apollo said, "This is my ground, man of Thebes. When you enter upon the ground of a god, you are well advised to expect to meet the god himself." "Yes, yes, I see that now," he said. "I wasn't exactly prepared for it, I admit." "This is the ground of the question," Apollo said, "for the question must ever be the faithful forerunner of the answer sought." Apollo gazed at the sacred tripod, frowning. His eyes flashed. "What are you doing with the sacred tripod, Heracles? It is mine." He delivered the question like an arrow from his bow. And he stepped towards Heracles and laid his hand on the tripod. Heracles said, "Pythia refused me the oracle. That is her privilege. What kind of priestess is this who can't perform every time?" "A discerning priestess." "Am I not a hero of great renown, having performed the 12 labors that King Eurystheus placed on me? 12 years I've served the task without faltering or turning aside. All should have been lost had I turned away just once, the way the priestess did, the way Xenocles did. These tasks you did exceedingly well, hero. There's no question of that. They were performed with Athena's help, I must add. But I must tell you that approaching my oracle is action of a different order. It is clear to me, Heracles, that you are in error in approaching the oracle. You are in error. Let go of the tripod." Heracles removed his right hand. "My lord, I want to find out what makes it work." Apollo was incredulous. "By stealing the holy seat of Pythia?" "Yes, there must be dynamis in that seat, force, power." "True, the tripod is her seat. That seat connects Pythia to the earth of G. Themis, who's the first holder here of the speaking wisdom on this mountain. If you'll just give me your blessing, I'll sit upon the tripod myself. This is the brew of madness. Were you not purified of the madness that caused you to slay your guest, Iphicus? Yes, I was purified by Deiphobus at Amycle. Look at me, Lord Apollo. If I seem mad to you, it is because things are urgent. You see in me the passion to know the answer, ever compelling my action. Ah, yes, when great need is wed to the desire to know, then Apollo is summoned. That's my condition. You see it plainly now. It is the human condition, actually. That is, when need is wed to the desire to know. It's the human condition. But the fact is that you're not ready for my oracle, Heracles. In stealing the holy tripod, you are driven toward making answers. This is hubris of the worst sort. Am I, Apollo, not the creator of the answer, bringing it forth from the mind of Zeus? Besides, you've overlooked the matter of the question. Take your covetous eyes off the tripod. Neither tripod nor its priestess can give you what is needed until you have gone the arduous path of the question. Now you speak in riddles. It only seems so because of the fact that the way to the oracle is winding. The distance between a thought and its conclusion is thought to be short and direct, but the distance between what is lived and one's conclusion upon it is long. I tell you, this long path is the crucial way. It tries one sorely, yet it is the way that yields at last the question. I've lived many years and have seen and done much. See that I'm no longer some young hoplite pursuing the chariot around the race course, if you will. True, sometimes years beget the question, and sometimes they do not. Twice in my life, facing grave consequences arising out of my rash deeds, I have come here to Pytho, Delphi, seeking Apollo's counsel. Both times did I not bring the question to Pythia? Has any traveler ever put his question more clearly, I ask you? Remember me, my lord, the young man of 12 years ago who stood before you utterly distraught from having slain his own children, misguided by a fit of madness. Was it not your oracle that decreed that I should serve Eurystheus of Tiryns, performing 10 superhuman labors? And in the end, he imposed 12 labors on you instead of 10. For the hero, there is no justice. These words comfort me, far shooter. Well, I've completed the 12 labors and the 12 years of servitude as well, only to fall in another dark chasm, the slaying of Iphitus. Now, Iphitus had been his host, and it's an unusually great crime to slay a host. Now, I'm going to shorten this so we get through. And then it seems that Heracles is suffering dreams nightly. And he says he's really pursued by the Furies. And he finally asks Apollo then, how am I to find the question? Apollo regarded him keenly and said, there lies before you a path that is free of the answers already given or already lived. I perceive that something in you greatly desires this grace of space to walk in. Free of what has already been lived. I do desire it. When was I not bound to task or what the people asked of me? The path of the great question is free of answers. You cannot run the question down like a prey, the way you did the Nemean lion. What can I do? Apollo says, there are many voices that cry out from you. Some are heard when you speak aloud, voices that desire something, and others railing against a thing, and voices at odds. Other voices are entombed in you and have no speech. Which voice has the question? Listen well. The many voices must be summoned in such a way that they become at last as one voice only. Wolves circle the fire at a little distance. It is the single voice. The question is the fire. It is the single voice that echoes in the hollow corridors at your core. Hearken to it. The many voices will come to attend to the one voice. When it comes, you will know it like a forgotten brother when the question comes. The question is your closest kindred, you see, and dwells close to the fire. Shall I be able to act, or will I be too shaken? It will not be action as you have known it, I think, for it has no spectacle and does not draw admiring observers. You must shepherd the question. That is the strangest labor yet for him. That is the strangest labor yet. He shook his head incredulously. Yes, Apollo said. Will Pythia receive me when I come as you have taught me? I believe she will. Turn about and go back to the temple's high plateau and seek out Pythia once more. I see in your face that you are wondering if you've yet come to the question. Go towards the oracle seat, and as you go, the question will form in you. Lord Apollo, the tripod is yours. Now that you see this, you must take the tripod and return it to the holy chamber where it belongs. Ah me, there will come a whole race of people who will steal the sacred tripod. His face grew somber, lost in vision. But go now and consult Pythia while my voice is still with her. May the graces go with you, Heracles. The god smiled, his radiance returned, and Heracles made the sacred sign and sang a paean to Apollo. And then he turned about and climbed once more towards the temple to return the tripod. The dialogue is based on a famous relief that you see in Delphi of the stealing of the tripod. So I'm open to your questions and comments, questions. Yes.
I was thinking when you were offering your metaphor of the psyche as a stage, and the theater does not own the actors. Mm-hmm. I was wondering where, when they're not on stage, do the actors dwell?
Where do they dwell? Well, if we knew that, we'd know the nature of archetypes and gods, and we would have penetrated the mystery. I suppose Jung would, I don't know, but would he not say something like that they reside in the collective unconscious, but that is again, a huge term to there's a feeling, I mean, there is an actual, in the experiential aspect of being inspired or the something numinous, there is a feeling of something from afar or out the door, or and one doesn't possess it or have it to refer to the same way as it as in one particular encounter or a few encounters. Yes.
I kind of had a feeling of like two different thoughts with what you were saying. And one was that what we're looking for in terms of the oracle was something that was very abstract and we would never really articulate well. And then the other was typically Apollo and whatever, of having very precise answers. Did you mean to put that kind of feeling across, or was that?
Now, first, that he had very precise answers.
Very definite. Answers,
very definite.
Like, you know,
very,
in,
very specific. Mm-hmm. Very specific answers.
And initially in your lecture, I got the feeling that more that these things were something that you would always be stumbling around, working with, trying to get a feel for, and living the life through them, but not definite.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, there is. You mean because of what I said about the Sphinx and the mystery, and something is never completely understood. The nature of the encounter with the self is never really understood. But I do think there is some very practical groundwork in inner work in the psyche, which is very down to earth and involves definite decisions, appropriate times, and so that, in a way, is a little analogous to things coming from the oracle, where the movement was ready. You know, now Athena also has this characteristic. She's not an oracle, but she had the wisdom of the next step. This is the way I always saw her. She has this great stride in the wisdom. And she always knew just why she was such a good guide for the hero, is she would tell what the next practical step would be. And you have some of that in the Oracle of Apollo, too. It's not grand cosmological philosophy or, you know, statements or abstract principles. But, I mean, that was its historical nature. I think you get from the self what you get. I mean, it's not going to resemble precisely. Yeah. If you're a philosopher, you're probably going to get philosophy from the self. If you have a philosophical connection. Yes.
I'm wondering if there are more specific instructions about how to move the question. Towards the end, I heard you say that, like, in the thing that you read, if the tripod is focused on energy, you focus the question. And earlier, I heard you say something about the question needing to be sheltered. Can I hear that correctly?
Well, or something like that. You have to tend the question. You have to take care of it and allow it to be shaped. I have been to Delphi quite a number of times. And about 2 years ago, or three, I thought, I've never taken a question to the Temple of Apollo, the ruin place. And I thought, well, that certainly is a testimony to something of the modern skeptic in me, you know. I mean, how can you go to an oracle place time after time and never bring a question? Or anything? Does that mean? So I prepared myself. It took a while. And I went alone, just my husband and I were visiting, and so I went alone to the place. Beck was where a French archaeologist had pointed out where he thought the tripod seat was. And so I went there, and I sat down, and I had a question which I had written out, something to do with my work. I don't remember even specifically exactly how it was worded, or something about my work. And then I just sat quietly, you know, just sat with the question. And I got an answer. I mean, something that came to me and I wrote down. And it was not an answer to the question I had asked, but it was the answer to the question I should have asked. And I thought that was an amazing experience. Well, and I don't mean should have in a guilt sense, but it went behind the question to something more fundamental. That's what it did. And and in fact, the answer intrigued me a lot. It had a little lilt to the answer that reminded me of some of the things I'd read in the historical oracles. It said something, I was proposing to write a certain book then, and it said something about the well of knowledge, but the well of knowledge has gone dry. And then it said something in praise of poetry, or the perception of the poet or something, but that the well of knowledge had gone dry. And something about it's not a well to draw from in the same way. Well, I'm sure it was something meant for me individually, but it was a very powerful experience and very telling to me. Now, you're asking how else could you prepare the question? Is that what you're asking? Well, before you could get the Pythia to sit, this doesn't quite, your goat, you had to bring an offering of a kid, and water was poured on the goat, and if the goat just shook its head a little bit, the god was not ready, and Pythia was not ready. But if the goat trembled all over from head to foot with the water, then the god was ready. Now, I just give you that information. I don't know what you'll do with it. But it certainly seems like it's a real testing out of the instinctual world of some very basic place first.
I don't want to appear too technical when I ask you this.
I probably can't answer it, so go ahead.
I'm not going to be able to attend your seminar, but I'm rather curious on the experience you just referenced. About how long did it take to go through this process in terms of time? Obviously, you didn't run up there, sit down, think of it.
At Delphi?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm not clear that it was like many days. You had to come in the season of the oracle. And in the very early times, she only gave the oracle once a year, but then later that changed considerably on the god's birthday. And then later it was always the 7th of every month. The 7th was his day. And then in August, there was a summer festival, and so it was longer. But I think you came and presented yourself to the priest, and you had your animal, and you... It wasn't a long process the way it was at Epidaurus. At Epidaurus, it might be many days with the dream oracle before it was decided whether you were ready to go to the dream pavilion porch and have the significant dream. You went through several levels, of purification and feeding the snakes in the sanctuary and several things at Epidaurus. But you didn't have that many different steps at Delphi. It wasn't particularly mystical from our point of view, from our modern point of view. But you did sing praise to Apollo and made your offering. And if you were a city-state, you would make a gift, too. There were many rich gifts given. But I don't know that it necessarily took very long.
Well, in your particular situation, I know you've had a lot of training and experience. When you have this answer.
Yeah.
The profound and the more deep an answer.
Yes.
Did you go through a preparation of a few days, a few weeks, a few months in doing this, or did you just
one afternoon? No. I stayed in Delphi for a week that time, and it was near the end of the week that I was there, maybe the fifth day or something, that I felt prepared enough to do that.
Okay, in tune
enough to do that, yes. It did take me several days, but then I could be slower than, but you know, it took me several days. Yeah. And then it was very simple. I'm rather shy with ritual, so you know I just did it very quietly. Nobody had any idea that I picked a late afternoon time where there was no one around.
That was attention.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I guess so. Yeah, it got the attention of the spirit of the place. Okay, now, I wish I could help you with the questions about framing the question. And I don't think in the last analysis, it's like coming into analysis or something. You don't always have a question, but you are seeking something, or a need gets focused, or a deep longing gets focused. And I think that's what's really essential, rather than the framing of the word. That is, in applying it to ourselves today. What were you going to ask? Yes?
When you were talking about how understanding and redeeming, if it's not, doesn't find the thought expression.
Yeah, that was quoting Jung's letter. Yes, somebody else asked about that reference, and I'm going to look that up tonight. I happen to have brought those letters with me. And so I'll let you know where you can find that. Yes?
I was wondering if you had a theory personally about why it was that the Pythia sat in a cooking pot. You know,
a cooking pot.
I mean, a tripod must have existed first as a cooking implement before it was.
And
it seems that it couldn't be insignificant.
No. Right. In a cauldron. Well, I don't know. Except that it's a vessel, and probably was a vessel used. I can't know that for sure, but a vessel used for the sacrificed animals, not used at Delphi for that, but in other places perhaps. You see, once the parts of the animal, the sacred parts, were given to the gods, the rest of the animal would have been cooked for the people, so that people always sat down and ate with the gods. You see, that was the meaning of festival. The other connection I get to it is at Dodona, where Zeus was, there was the use of cauldrons in delivering the oracle. There was a whole group of cauldrons under the sacred oak tree, and they were set next to each other, and they would strike them, one cauldron, and the tone would go through all of them, vibrating and vibrating. And from that, the priest would interpret the god's message. That was after the period when they didn't interpret it from the oak leaves anymore. But it is a vessel. It is a kind of an offering vessel. Mm-hmm. Anything else? But of course, do with it what you like. I mean, it's a symbol. It's an image. See what it says to you. Yes. That was my own dialogue based on the myth of Heracles stealing the tripod. Thank you. Yes. So, anything else? Yes.
Heracles and Hercules, were they actual human beings?
It's the same person. Heracles was a probably a historic figure. I think the legends were not all, you know, who can say the nature of legend? But he was an unusually strong man and a king, and king of Thebes, I guess, at one point. That's the best I can say. Theseus probably is likely to have lived as Theseus. It was a legendary rather than mythological. It's hard to, there's so much myth that crosses over with the history. No. But Theseus was an early king of Athens, and there are many myths about his feats. Okay. Anything else now? All right, I hope to see you tomorrow.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.